This is a podcast from Consilio. We bring people together to create better places.
Hello and welcome to Better Places, a podcast from Consilio where we talk about planning, politics and all sorts of other things affecting the capital and beyond. I'm Nathan Parsad-Wyatt.
That's less catchy than property, planning and politics.
That's what we normally say, isn't it?
Yeah.
Hello and welcome to Better Places, a podcast from Consilio where we talk all things...
property, planning and politics.
I'm Nathan Parsad-Wyatt.
And I'm Luke Francis.
There we go, that was much better.
Nice.
In today's episode, we've got the Lee Executive Member for Finance, Planning, Performance in the London Borough of Islington joining us, Dermot Ward.
Very exciting.
Yeah, very interesting, actually, to hear what he's got to say about all things Islington. So we'll be getting to that soon. But as you know, we start these with a little roundup of politics, and it's certainly not been a dull week in politics so far. We've had the Northern Ireland Protocol Agreement, apparently, coming through, the Windsor Agreement, so nationally quite significant. I think the Prime Minister would take it as a broad victory at the moment, although by the time this goes out, who knows, the DUP could have destroyed it, half the Conservative Party could be opposing it, and we could be on another leadership
election.
But I think so far so good on that front, and certainly everyone I've spoken to who's involved in politics at that level is fairly positive about the way it's been received. But separate to that, it's interesting that the whole, you know, there is a lot of chatter about the next general election, and Keir Starmer has been outlining kind of a platform really for Labour, you know, sort of around these five national missions, as he calls them, to kind of guide what the next Labour administration may look like.
How many of those five can you name?
So let's give it a go. Economy, grow the economy.
Well, specifically,
presumably he doesn't want to shrink the economy. Oh, fastest growing economy in the G7.
Yep, highest sustained growth in the G7.
Yeah,
yep.
Because there was that whole thing about needing to make sure that we were growing faster than Poland, I read.
Yeah,
which I thought was
strange metric, but yeah,
it was an interesting target. Not my metric. So anyway, grow the economy, sort out the NHS.
An NHS fit for the future. Sort out the NHS.
Which I guess sort out the NHS probably would have been more catchy.
Yeah.
Three
more. Think Blair.
Immigration? No, that wouldn't be on there. No. Education.
Break down the barriers to opportunity.
Is that education?
Yeah, every child, reforming the childcare and education systems.
There's going to be one on crime, isn't there?
There is.
Yeah, crime. Presumably not increasing it, but reducing crime.
Again, yeah. Your political insight is unrivaled. Make Britain's streets safer, yeah.
And then, what's the fifth one? I'm not going to get it.
Make Britain a clean energy superpower.
Oh, yeah, very good. So, five clear priorities for the next administration. Noticing that housing is missing, which is a shame.
Well,
but he did say something about it this week.
He did. Labour have started to set out their stall, particularly when it comes to building new homes. I think the housing crisis and setting out a case for tackling the housing crisis is going to be one of the key pillars of the next general election.
Yeah, I think so too.
I think, you know, we've seen at every stage of the property market, private renters, you know, we know young people at the minute who are really struggling to secure decent accommodation.
Do you remember when we were young people?
No, not anymore.
But it is, yeah, no, it's terrible.
But also, not to sound like a forced, you know, God, I can't believe how old I am. But I think it was different when we moved
to
London, even,
definitely,
you know, whatever that was, 15 years ago. Okay.
Well, all right, mate.
12 years ago?
No, 2011 was when
12 years ago.
We both moved to London.
Yeah. But I think, you know, it's changed dramatically, and there's now, on average in London, 19 potential tenants for every rental property. We're losing the equivalent of 66 private rented properties a day as private landlords leave the market. House building, there was a report out from the Home Builders Federation last week that said that house building rates could drop to a post-war low in response to Michael Gove's watering down of housing targets.
Yeah,
in
not
response
good.
To backbench pressure.
Mind you. Well, yeah, no, I do agree with that. It was good to hear Labour speak about planning reform. But then what I would say is, you know, we all know that the only way you solve this is to build more houses. And well, you've got administrations that we're working with, both Labour and Conservative and Lib Dem, that, you know, are bowing to pressure in some cases from their electorate, which I understand, and not building the homes that we need. So, I think it was good that they're talking about it and have identified planning as a problem, but what does it actually look like to solve that?
Well, so I think a couple of things. There's, there's a very sort of established rule that you don't want to put forward really good policies potentially this far out from a general election, because governments can steal them and implement them, or steal them, water them down and implement them, and it sort of takes away from the benefit that it provides the opposition running into a campaign. But also, we're at least a year out from a general election, probably longer. And so at this point, I'm not sure we would expect an opposition to come forward with a clearly worked up plan. But
no.
I do take the criticism that, talking in broad terms about a system, and particularly in this instance, the planning system not working, is, a diagnosis of the problem rather than setting out a potential solution. But the fact that it's even being discussed, particularly in our industry and the areas we work in, it is positive to hear, senior national politicians talking about the system being broken and not working, and there being a need for an alternative. I think the challenge, we talked about it a couple of days ago, Rachel Reeves, the Shadow Chancellor, was on doing sort of the morning media round, and she shied away from directly answering the question of, are you going to go against communities when it comes to development?
Which is the part of the problem, right? Sometimes decision makers have to make decisions that are, on the face of it, unpopular in the short term in order to be popular in the long term.
And we have a political system that discourages long-term planning and taking short-term unpopular decisions to deliver long-term benefits. That's the reality of, having an election every 5 years and being able to boot people out when they, start to make significant changes.
But it would be nice if a lot of people standing for politics or standing in politics and standing at elections just weren't so bothered by that and
that's
bothered about achieving something.
Today, you're announcing your candidacy to run as an independent in next year's London mayoral elections.
Yeah, exactly. But actually, that's a good point. Good segue, Luke.
If you hadn't flagged that, it would have been a good segue.
Yeah, true. Yeah. Smooth as ever. Maybe I'll cut it out later.
Yeah.
We have obviously been talking about the general election, and that is all anyone's talking about at the moment. But because of the slightly shortened term that Sadiq has had for his second term since last election, we go to the polls in London next year for the Maryland GLA election. So
430-odd days away.
It's not very long.
It isn't long.
And I think that I look at, we don't even have a Conservative candidate yet. We know that Sadiq's going to stand again. Who knows what the other parties will do. But
any runners and riders?
Well,
on the Conservative side?
I was thinking back to when Sean Bailey, the previous Conservative candidate, was selected. I mean, it was a good 2.5 years before the election.
Too early.
Too early, which those of us who were there at the time actually argued for, but anyway, lost that one. let's not go into that. But no, there are a few people who have said that they're interested in standing for the Conservatives. One is Andrew Boff, who's tried to stand. He's a current Assembly member, been around for many, many years in London Conservative politics. He will no doubt throw his hat in the ring again to get selected. He has at every chance he's had for the last 4 or 5 cycles. So it may well be that this is his time, and and in fairness to him, he understands London inside out and has some really good ideas on different policies. But so he will no doubt throw his hat in the ring. Sam Kasumu, he was a special advisor to Boris Johnson for a time. He is very interested in standing and is kind of building his campaign.
One to watch
potentially, but it might well be that nobody really picks up on this until the autumn. But although I think conventional wisdom would say that Sadiq is going to win very convincingly.
Sorry, the crashing in the background is not a Benny Hill sketch. It's just the team that obviously saw the maintenance of our office. They load the dishwasher like they're angry with it. And so what you can hear in the background is
the crashing of mugs.
Yeah, so apologies.
But
let's talk about a candidate who we know is going to be on that.
Yeah, so Sadiq Khan is going to stand, and he's standing for a third term.
That difficult third album,
yeah. And presumably he's going to try and play some of his greatest hits during the campaign.
Yeah, I mean, I think...
What would they be? What does it look like?
So I think it's you know, I strongly suspect this will be Sadiq's third and last term if he's successful. I think, you know, it's a long time to do any role, but, you know, a role that is as demanding and high profile. And, you know, I listened to, you put me on to, what's that podcast?
Diary of a CEO.
Yeah, I shouldn't be advertising other people's podcasts, but I feel like we're probably not in
I'm not sure that we're in his league.
But it was really interesting.
Really interesting interview.
To him, you know, he's talking about the more sort of personal human cost of doing a role like that. And so I think, you know, three terms is probably enough for anyone, and unprecedented. But what does it look like as a campaign platform? At the minute, I don't think we can say for certain. I think we can predict with a high degree of accuracy what the key issues are going to be. I think it's going to be, you know, crime and policing is going to be a massive one with everything that's happened with the Met over the last couple of years. I think getting to grips with that is going to be a huge part of it.
I think
ULEZ is going to be, you know,
big issue in the outer boroughs.
Probably the top issue in the outer boroughs. I think we've already seen four London local authorities threaten legal action, and Surrey Council jumped on that bandwagon. So there's potential for that too.
Croydon said they would have joined it as well, but unfortunately they can't afford to pay the legal bills.
They'd need legal aid to join. But, you know, so there is a real sort of sense that the outer London boroughs are going to be a difficult battleground. And one way to counter that is potentially to try and stack up those votes in inner London, you know, the traditional Labour heartlands, you know, your Camdens, your Hackneys, your Islingtons. And one way of doing that is to pivot to the left. And we're already seeing, you know, Sadiq has left tendencies on a lot of big policy issues and things around like rent controls. You know, Sadiq has been over to New York several times and come back praising, you know, some of the policies that are implemented over there about rent controls. We've had conversations with people in the industry who have, let's say, differing views about how successful it
would
be.
Vastly different views, I think it's fairly safe to say.
Vastly different views. But, you know, these are policies that are very popular with, you know, particularly young inner London voters who are struggling either to find decent private rental accommodation, desperately trying to save to buy their first homes, and watching, you know, property prices continue to tick up and, you know, mortgage rates going up as well. So
it's an interesting thought experiment then. So next election, the Conservative candidate kind of tries to make it a bit of a referendum on ULEZ, for want of a better thing, or a referendum on Sadiq's perceived failures. So crime, tries to lay some of the housing crisis blame at his door for not building enough. I'm not sure that one will stick, but potentially gives it a go, and ULEZ. And potentially scoops up a lot of those votes in the outer boroughs slash just people generally who maybe don't feel safe in central London, etc. Then, like you say, Sadiq then has the kind of centre slash left vote and pivots increasingly to the left to try and secure that vote. What happens if Jeremy Corbyn stands as an independent?
Because in Islington?
As a candidate for London Mayor. Jeremy Corbyn is not going to stand as a Labour candidate for Islington North at the next election. This campaign will be before the next election. His biggest support base by a country mile is in London, among those very people that you were just talking about that Sadiq might need to reach out to. Wonder what happens if he stands as an independent.
So By the way,
I have no insight on whether that could actually happen or not. No. But
But I think to play the hypothetical game, and I would caveat all of this by saying he wouldn't do that, I think, for lots of different reasons. But to play that hypothetical game, what probably happens is there's a high correlation between the vote that he gets and either existing Labour members or Labour members who joined and left over the last 5 or 6 years, and, you know, young, fairly left voters in London. You know, I don't think he gets anywhere near Sadiq's total from last time. But what it potentially does is, you know, split a Labour vote and give the Tories a run through the middle. But
then, because of the way the voting system works with first and second preferences, ultimately, if you vote for Jeremy Corbyn first, you're probably voting for Sadiq second, and he scoops it up on the second round anyway. So,
I mean, potentially, I think there is, you know, a big chunk of this hypothetical. God, we've really gone down a rabbit.
We have slightly, but what I would say to bring it back to Jeremy Corbyn's patch, it is Islington. And I think it probably is time.
I see what you've done. Yeah. It's a ham-fisted segue.
It probably is time.
And I'm going to shine the spotlight on it.
Not hear from us, although we will be talking more and more about the Birrell election, I expect, as the weeks and months go on and different things happen. But let's hear now, I think, less of us and more from Dermot.
And I'm delighted to be joined by Dermot Ward, who is the Deputy Leader and Exec Member for Finance, Planning and Performance at Islington Council. Dermot, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me, Luke. Lovely to be here.
No, it's great to have you. Now, Dermot, I think I'm right in saying that you've been a councillor in Islington for coming up to 9 years. You were first elected back in 2014.
That's absolutely right, Luke. Heady days of 2014 seem like a long time ago now.
Well, it feels like a distant memory. But your background is in criminal law, isn't it? So
that's
how did
right.
you end up involved in politics?
So, I mean, politics has always been my thing since I've been very young. And, I mean, I worked in legal aid as a solicitor. And, I mean, what I found when I was in private practice, I was actually much more interested in kind of the policy behind criminal justice than the law itself. I'm not sure how good an actual lawyer I was. And, I mean, one of the things that always struck me was just how poorly funded the criminal justice system was, and you know it's not good for the defendant. It's certainly not good for the victim either. If you don't have a properly funded criminal justice system, you know, Highbury Corner Magistrates Court is only 5 minutes walk from where I am now in Islington Town Hall, and you can see the consequences of austerity, you know, as you go in the front door of the court, with things being held together with masking tape, broken toilets, hearings being delayed. You know, it struck me very early on that the criminal justice system is broken, and certainly the legal aid system is broken. And you know, that's why I'm in politics. I want to see public services thrive so that working people can live and thrive and have good lives. And I think that kind of, it's, you know, legal aid by its very definition is very political. It's all about access to justice for all.
Yeah.
When the opportunity came up to be a councillor in my local area in Islington, I jumped at the chance.
And it's been a hectic few years for you since you were elected. So you became the exec member for housing and development back in 2016, and then became deputy leader following last year's local election. So how's that been?
That's right. Well, it's hard, but it's a role I absolutely love. I started doing the housing and planning executive role in 2016. Became deputy leader in May 2021, and after the May elections, took on a new brief, finance, policy, and performance, which is some aspects of my old brief remain. So I still have council new build in my new brief, which I'm very, very pleased about. And I've still got residential planning in my new brief, along with new responsibilities around finance and resources, and particularly the budget, which is a huge challenge in itself. But I think it's a good fit. I think it's a good combination because, you know, for council housing, but getting social rent housing built, you know, that's all about, you know, the infrastructure of the borough, which I feel kind of fits pretty well with the finance stuff and the budget stuff. So it's a challenging brief because it's so wide ranging, but I love it.
And how much of it is about, I think, the boroughs where you see real sort of on the ground change and there are things you can point to that are delivered through local government and through councils? The common denominator amongst all of them is that really clear political vision from the leadership down. How much of a role does that play in both your exec role and also the deputy leader role of setting that political vision for the council?
I think that's bang on, Luke. I mean, we pride ourselves on being a member-led council, and we pride ourselves on being a council that gets things done. You know, we've got very, very clear political vision here. You know, when we first came to office in 2010, we talked a lot about going back to the basics of jobs, housing and the cost of living. And we've talked a lot about fairness. We've had a fairness commission here at the council. We talk a lot about a more equal Islington, and that has to inform everything that we do. We want a fairer, a cleaner, a greener and a safer Islington, and that has to be at the core of everything. And, you know, the built environment is absolutely key to that. And, you know, getting council homes built is absolutely key to that, and working with partners to get social rent homes built. I think that has to inform everything we do.
And you've just touched on it there, but to sort of look at Islington as a borough, it is incredibly diverse, like a lot of inner London boroughs. You know, it has pockets of extreme wealth and real deprivation. You've got city fringe, you've got more leafy residential areas, you've got large council estates. How does that diversity impact the council's approach to policy making?
So it is a diverse borough, Luke. It's also a very, very small borough and a very dense borough. So these things don't just happen side by side. I think these things happen effectively on top of each other. And that's the lovely thing about Islington, kind of how, kind of, you will find a very proper looking Victorian street. If you look more closely, you'll find that probably half of the dwellings on that old Victorian Terrace Street are council homes, and we're very, very proud that so many of our council homes are older street properties, properties that were bought up in the 70s and 80s when these things were possible by councils. And I think there is a great diversity, and there's a lot of work to be done to make it into a more equal borough. But I think that's reflected in everything we do. You know, our policies are all about how do we make sure everybody's got the best possible start in life. How do we make sure everyone's got the best access to opportunities in education, in employment, and a home that they can afford, and a home that where they can live and thrive.
And how impacted is the work you're able to do by resource now and limitations on budget? Is Islington in the place where it's starting to have to make really difficult decisions, or is that still a little way down the road in terms of services and what you're able to do proactively as well?
Absolutely, Luke. So over the last 13 years, we have lost just under £300 million of government funding. And that's over a 13-year period. This year alone, we've had to find £12 million of savings, and that is hugely difficult for our residents, and very, very hard choices have to be made by councillors. But we do pride ourselves, and as a Labour councillor, we make these decisions collectively as a group of councillors, and you've got just the twin evils right now, this cost of living crisis, the twin evils of inflation making everything much more expensive, and interest rates as well going up, meaning it's just much more difficult to build any kind of infrastructure in the borough, including council homes. So the landscape is incredibly challenging, Luke, but we're still here. We're still doing our very best to prioritise and deliver frontline services to our residents. We're acutely aware of the cost of living crisis, and that informs everything we do right now. And in this year's budget, which is going to full council at the beginning of March, we've announced a £1 million hardship fund, which recognises that there is a cost of living crisis. Food bills are going up, rents are going up, heating bills are going up, and we want to do everything we possibly can to support residents through that. So we're very proud that despite all of these challenges, we've been able to put in that £1 million hardship fund as part of our budget this year.
And we talk about the sort of current sort of difficult financial context, and as you say, the cost of living crisis feeling like it's dominating every aspect of everyone's lives at the moment. But you've also got, I guess, a bit of a hangover from the last couple of years in terms of the pandemic and the impact that's had on people, you know, socially, economically. It's had a, you know, a really significant impact on people's lives. Is that something you've seen in Islington in terms of, you know, how people's working patterns, the high streets, footfall, those sort of things? Is Islington back to where it was before the pandemic, or is there still a bit of a hangover there?
I think some things have changed, and, you know, maybe some things have changed for good. And that's, you know, that's not a bad thing that made that in certain ways. I think we learned a lot of lessons in the pandemic, particularly about new ways of working and the future of work. And, you know, I think there is a, an awful lot more kind of working from home now and embracing technology just like we're doing now. I mean, I'm a technophobe, and even doing this podcast is a new experience for me. But I think I think it's a good thing that, you know, that a lot of employers have embraced new technology and are looking at home working. And I think we got to take the positives of that. You know, does that mean that we need fewer office spaces? And does that mean that we can make better use of our council buildings? You know, can we lower our carbon footprint? Can we, you know, use that space to build council homes or for other services? What are the real positives we can get out of that change in working?
Yeah, it's really, so our offices are based in Moorgate, and as I look out the window here across the road, it's the boundary with Islington. And as you just said, you know, about office space, there are a few buildings I can see just being finished as we speak. And, you know, you wonder if, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, you know, whether or not that demand will still be there, or whether or not, as you say, the changing nature of people's working patterns, more working from home, means that actually in 5 years or in 10 years time, the city will look very different. You know, that city fringe, Clerkenwell, Bun Hill, those sort of areas will look very different. Does that feature in your thinking now, and the council's thinking about how do we adapt for, you know, 5-10 years time down the line if these patterns continue to remain the same?
Absolutely, part of our thinking, Luke. And it's in terms of where we are as a borough. You know, there's a really difficult landscape for small local businesses. You know, it's very, 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 very expensive to rent premises in Islington, particularly on the city fringe. So I think what we've got to do is, you know, we've got to look at the positives around this. You know, does this provide us with more opportunities? Does this provide us with more opportunities for affordable workspace programs for helping small businesses? And I think if you, looking out your window there, Luke, you know, if you walk up from Moorgate Station, past Finsbury Square into Islington, you know, you've got the red brick estate there. You've got Braithwaite House. You've got, you know, quite, you know, lots of kind of Islington communities that have been there for many, many decades. You know, have been part of that city community, and I think it probably presents opportunities. You know, how do we, you know, how many people on our council estates, just on the city fringes, are actually employed in the city? How many of them could be? How many kind of small businesses for our residents could we create around the city fringes? And if there is surplus office space, you know, how do we make best use of that?
Absolutely. I think one thing that, you know, I spent a long time working for the Labour Party in various guises, and I, you know, one thing that always seemed to be true was that proximity to opportunity isn't the same as access. And actually, you know, you can Absolutely. Be 50 yards from the city, but actually it can feel like a 1,000 miles if you don't have the opportunity to actually benefit from what's on offer there. Let's talk a bit about your priorities and Islington Council's priorities. And you touched on one of them there. I think when I think about Islington Council and their sort of red lines, the first things I think of are affordable homes, affordable workspace. Why are these so important to Islington?
So I think it goes back to very, very basic principles, Luke. And what do we actually want for our borough? I want a borough where people can live, can raise their families, and can absolutely thrive. Now, there's two keys to that. The first thing, you can't live and thrive and take advantage of all the opportunities there are unless you've got a safe, secure, and affordable home. If you're in temporary accommodation, if you're sofa surfing, if you're having to live with relatives, or you're just not sure, even if you're in the private sector and you're just not sure whether that privately rented home is going to be available there next year or the year after, or how much the rent's going to be the next year or the year after, and particularly during this cost of living crisis. And I've seen private sector rents go through the roof. I've seen queues of people, even when a room becomes available in a privately rented house, queues of people queuing up and kind of almost bidding wars there on the spot as to how much rent people can pay. That's not a situation where a family can live and thrive and get an education and take advantage of opportunities. So that's why, incidentally, we don't use the phrase affordable homes here. We talk about genuinely affordable homes. The reason being that the governance definition, which includes homes of up to 80% market rent, we don't feel that's affordable for most people in Islington. So we tend to use the phrase genuinely affordable homes. But part and parcel of that, so you've got, you need a genuinely affordable home to be able to live and to thrive and take advantage of opportunities. But you also need local jobs. We don't want to be a dormitory borough. We know other parts of London have seen kind of moves in that direction, and that's not who we are. We want people to be able to get access to good quality local jobs. We want to help good quality small. We want to grow our own local small businesses, and that's why affordable workspace is really important as well.
Yeah, no, it completely makes sense. And as you say, you know, it's about where that opportunity is and providing that foundation for people to be able to live and work and flourish in the borough. I think, you know, in Islington, as with probably every inner London borough and actually increasingly every outer London borough now, the development environment is increasingly difficult. Land values are going up, construction costs are going up, labour, materials. From your position in your exec role, do you think it's becoming harder to bring forward developments that deliver the homes, the workspace, the green spaces that Islington needs and wants?
Yes. But I can probably elaborate on that. it's harder than ever before, Luke, for all kinds of reasons. I mean, the most recent reason, like I was talking about earlier, is just the twin evils of both inflation and interest rates means it's much, much more difficult to get homes built. And even for a local authority like ours, where we have access to the borrowing through the Public Works Loan Board, even those interest rates are much, much higher than they were before. And, you know, for every 1% that interest rates go up, then that's a huge consequence for the cost of building council homes. So on that level, on the most recent developments, it's become much more difficult. But it goes much, much further than that, particularly for an inner London borough like ourselves. We've been doing, we're very, very proud that we've been building council homes ever since Gordon Brown and John Healey gave the go-ahead for councils to start building new homes again in 2008. We're very, very proud. We've had a long programme of building council homes. And that's concentrated very much on infill developments, looking at our estates, how we can make our estates better, how we can build new homes on our estates. Because, of course, we don't have access to funds to buy land for ourselves. And even if we did, there are no kind of huge brownfield sites in Islington waiting to be developed. You've got to be creative about what you look at. So that's why our estate infill became such a big part of what we do. We've built brand new council homes out of old garages. We're looking at building on top of existing buildings. We've looked at some of our estates from the 50s, 60s, 70s. Often, you know, there were kind of design mistakes made. Often you've got dead areas of estates that are a good place to build new council homes. And we're very, very fond of building new council homes in car parks. We think that makes an awful lot of sense. Very, very few residents of Islington actually own a car. Many of the garages built on council estates don't even fit modern cars. And if we are going to be serious about net zero carbon and about the climate emergency, then, you know, building new council homes on car parks makes perfect sense. So much going on, Luke. We're very, very proud that planning approval has just been given for a new passive house council development at Vorley Road, which is in the Archway area. And that really, I think that is the future. If we can build genuinely affordable homes at passive house standards, which not only provide homes for families in desperate need, but also address the climate emergency, and address the skills shortage. We need to train apprentices who are apprentices who are fit for the net zero carbon retrofit and able to build houses to Passive House standards. It just ticks so many boxes about, you know, what we should be doing to, you know, to help people to live and to thrive in the borough. You know, new homes and addressing the skills shortage and fighting the climate emergency. So lots of great things going on, but it's becoming harder and harder. There aren't any easy sites in Islington. It's unlikely there'll be any easy sites in the future. We were very, very proud to work with Peabody and London Square on the new Holloway Prison development, where I understand spades have just gone into the ground on that development. We are extremely proud that that's 60% genuinely affordable homes. An awful lot of work went into that and achieving that. And I will work, and I mean, the whole council will work with anyone who wants to help us to get genuinely affordable homes built in Islington. And anyone who's listening to this podcast and has creative ideas or an opportunity to build genuinely affordable homes in Islington, do come and talk to us.
I think there'll be a lot of people listening with interest, and you know, so many examples there of a creative approach. And there are a few, I'm very biased, you know, but I can think of a few Labour councils where that's the case, where innovative, creative thinking is getting around some of these challenges. Is there also a sense of an increasing need to be flexible when it comes to development? And going back to those red lines, is there a sense that the council needs to look at that list of priorities and sometimes flex on which are the top of that priority list and which are maybe slightly lower? Or is there a sort of political consensus that these are our red lines and actually anything that can't deliver these simply can't be brought forward because we aren't willing to compromise on some of these areas?
So we have a very strict planning policy around genuinely affordable homes. Our planning policy says that any development of over 10 homes must be 50% genuinely affordable. When we're very, very clear what we mean by genuinely affordable, of that 50%, 35% must be social rent. What I tend to describe as old school council rent, because people tend to know what you mean when you say it like that. Then we leave the other 15% for some kind of intermediate homes. Shared ownership has been a popular one in previous years, although even shared ownership is becoming a very difficult product in Islington, just because even people on medium incomes are now struggling to be able to afford a shared ownership home. We're also encouraging London Living, the Mayor's new London Living rent, where the rent is a third of the median income in that ward, or can't be more than a third of the median income in that ward. And we're always on the lookout for other intermediate products for that 15%. A home that will suit someone who's not going to get onto a council housing register, but at the same time works in the borough and wants to live in the borough and wants to be part of our community. Our 50% red line is non-negotiable. We've been all the way to the High Court on that, and we're very proud that we've been all the way to the High Court on that. The case in question is a case around the Parkhurst Road site, which is a previous Ministry of Defence site on the corner of Parkhurst Road and Holloway Road, and that's the case where the developer came to planning committee and offered a derisory 10%, and we just weren't having that. They eventually went to the Planning Inspectorate, they then judicially reviewed the Planning Inspectorate, and it went all the way to the High Court, and the judge in that case was very, very clear that if someone's going to buy, you know, prime real estate in central London, then they need to take advice on what the planning rules are, and you shouldn't pay a price that doesn't allow you to adhere to planning rules.
That's an expensive lesson to learn, I suspect, for them.
Exactly.
Now, Dermot, you've been so generous with your time. Just one last question from me, and I'm going to be cheeky and ask it in two parts. So,
of course,
we're going to have a general election at some point in the next 2 years, because we haven't had enough in the last couple of years. Hopefully sooner, yeah. I think the sooner the better. Now, the first part of the question is the next government going to be a Labour-led government?
I sincerely hope so, Luke. I sincerely hope so. And I will be doing everything I possibly can to ensure that it is a Labour government.
No complacency.
We can't be complacent about these things. And as Islington Labour councillors, we're very proud that we have Labour councillors on the doorsteps every single weekend. We shouldn't be complacent about... We shouldn't take votes for granted, and we shouldn't be complacent. And... The road to ruin is not keeping in touch with residents, not regularly asking residents how do they feel about this, how do they feel about that, how do we make things better. We're never going to be perfect. There's always room for making things better, and it's important that we're constantly talking to our residents. And I think anyone who wants a Labour government should take that on board. We've all got to be out on the doorsteps talking to residents right across the country.
I'm going to go deep into our sort of geeky political history here, but I mean, if there's ever an example of the impact and success of targeted campaigning, Islington is it. You know, I think people can forget, because it feels like Labour heartland. This was a Lib Dem controlled council up until...
Certainly was
it
2000? Luke, yeah.
Yeah, and I remember...
Until 2010, shit. That's right. Yeah. That's that's absolutely right, and that was a failure on our part. That was a failure on the part of Islington Labour. You know, we weren't talking to our residents. We weren't on the doorsteps, and my branch, Holloway, at one stage wasn't even meeting. So it's not hard to predict what was going to happen next. So we should never take a single vote for granted. The lessons of the past show what happens when you take votes for granted. And yeah, I mean, we now have 48 seats on the council, but we don't take one single vote for granted. And we know how much work goes into actually earning those votes.
Yeah, absolutely. And the second part of this very protracted final question is, if Labour finds itself in government at the next general election, what key policy or policy changes would you like to see implemented when it comes to planning and development? What do you think needs to change?
So one very successful policy of the previous Labour government was the Decent Homes Programme. Now, at that time, the Decent Homes Programme focused on new windows, kitchens, bathrooms, which was a good thing to do at that time. I'd like to see a new Decent Homes Programme, but a Decent Homes Programme with a focus on retrofitting homes to net zero carbon standards for the future. Let's have a national programme of retrofitting council and social rent homes so that they're fit for the future, that we address, firstly, the climate emergency through getting homes up to net zero carbon standard. We address the cost of living crisis by helping people get their heating bills down with much, much more energy efficient homes. And we address the skills crisis. Let's train people to do air source heat pumps. Let's train people to do ground source heat pumps. Let's make sure that we have all of the skills to do all of these things. It's a win-win for everybody. Decent Homes was a wonderful idea at the time, but it's time for Decent Homes 2. And Decent Homes 2 needs to have much, much more of a focus on retrofit for net zero carbon standards. The other thing I'd like to see, quite apart from that, is just a national commitment to a national council home building programme. That's absolutely vital if we are to address the housing crisis. Obviously, we need to build more homes, full stop. But London property is often a global reserve currency. You can build lots and lots of private homes without making a dent in affordability. So we need to make sure that we're building the right kinds of homes. council homes, homes that working people in London can afford. We're doing our bit in Islington, but we're a small borough, and the current rules around this make it exceedingly difficult to build council homes. The grant only covers a third of the cost of a new home. You've still got right to buy, so we're losing homes at the same time. Even when we do get the money from a right to buy home, the Treasury takes 25% of that. Of the remaining receipt, we're only allowed to apply that to a third of a new council home. And then, to top it all off, you can't combine a right to buy receipt with grant. So invariably, you've always got to find the other two-thirds of the cost of a council home through cross-subsidy and through borrowing. We can't continue with a situation where the government actually stacks the deck against councils that want to build council homes. We need to go back to the spirit of 1945 when, and I understand between 1945 and 1952, the UK built 700,000 new council homes. It's the housing crisis isn't an act of God. It's the culmination of political choices. And the way we're going to solve it is to have it through a national campaign of council housing. And at the same time, that could also, it could fill the skills gap. It could lead to so many more apprenticeships and so many more skilled jobs that are sadly lacking. We should be at the forefront of this. We should be at the global forefront of building net zero carbon homes, building passive house standard homes, and let's show the whole world what we can do and address the housing crisis at the same time.
I think you may have just written Labour's next manifesto, Dermot.
I do hope so, Luke.
I'm going to be sending this episode to my old boss, Lisa Nandy and Matt Pennycook.
I look forward to it. Lisa's coming to Islington tonight. She's coming to the Islington South Dinner tonight, so maybe I'll tell her myself.
Fantastic. I look forward to seeing this in the next manifesto. But Dermot, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us today.
A pleasure. A real pleasure, Luke. Anytime. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks very much.
Take care.
And that's it from this episode of Better Places. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to subscribe, like, share, comment. Anything else you do with the podcast?
No, I think just send it round to all your friends and neighbours and family.
Yeah. Yeah, tape it onto a you know, mini disc. And
okay. I think everyone gets the idea.
Cool.
All right.
Thanks for listening.
Bye. 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 Bye.